I mean, it sounds bad.
Oh, it makes me so angry, Scott.
It makes you quanky. It makes you very quanky. Oh, I can tell you're quanky. Oh, no.
Now I want to hit you.
Uh-oh, he's
Oh,
quanky.
you son of a
Oh, the
bitch.
website doesn't work, and
Oh,
now
I'm gonna
he's
Oh, you son
quankers.
of a bitch.
Oh, no. Oh, this is terrible. Oh, he would hit a person. He's so angry he would hit a person because the website doesn't work.
I'm gonna remember this, you motherfucker. You son of a bitch.
Oh, that was real good. That was great.
Oh, God. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or the other thing, my name is The People's Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am the Scott of not reacting. I am not taking that bait today. I am the movie guy, and we, James and I, are here to help you, dear listener. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. Today, we're doing it with five and a half movies that I love.
Five and a half, huh?
Out of seven, I like, you know.
Five and a half of them?
Yeah, I like parts of two and much of three and most of seven. But well, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. This might be a. It's not a pairing.
This is nothing except it might be an accidental metatextual crossover. We'll get to that as well.
Love it.
We're on to this is like maybe part four of our latest miniseries, Comfort Food Movies. Through, you know, scheduling mishaps, we didn't have a guest available to record yet for this week, but we still wanted to record something. And we've both been like jonesing on the Mission Impossible movies leading up to the release of Dead Reckoning Part One. We were both watching them all anyway. So fuck it. We'll just do an episode about Mission Impossible.
And for sure, Mission Impossible 1 has been a comfort food movie for me in the past.
They have all been for me.
I'm new to the four on, but...
Yeah. Prior to this week with this like big rewatch, since I've been on Letterboxd, which is 9 years, I have watched a Mission Impossible movie, whichever one it might be, 15 times in 9 years.
Does that include this rewatch?
No, that's prior to the seven that I've just now watched in the last week. So, yeah, a lot. But, yeah, so we watched them all. The new one is out as of this recording. It's been out as of, like, not even 48 hours. Jamie and I have seen it. We will be discussing that later on. There will be a spoiler warning before we get into that discussion because I'm sure we won't be able to stop ourselves. And we're just going to talk about missions, about them missions, Jamie.
Those missions... Which I contend mostly are possible.
This is like...
Because they were done.
Both a annoying take from you and just like a useless contrarian point of view.
That's
like
correct.
I've got to be a contrarian, but I actually liked all of these movies. So I'm going to nitpick the name, which is just dope. The name is just good. Like, shut up. It's great.
I do it because it bothers you. You know that, right?
What are we drinking? There's this bottle here that's next to me. What
there
is in
is.
It?
So on the beverage side of things, because we're doing, I decided to sort of slide in a little bit of my ethos into the comfort food. Because I think that we all need to be adjusting our palates as the climate changes, and certain things are viable to grow in a responsible way, and certain other things are maybe not. I think we all need to be drinking more hybrids, more co-ferments, more beverages of other types that aren't based on vinifera grapes, which are quite difficult to grow, because our climate is fucked. So I'll be getting to defining all of the things that I just said later, but for now, we're opening a bottle of Barry Family Cellar Pet Nat. That's G-N-A-T. There's a little picture of a guy with a gnat on a leash on the bottle. It's a Petit Naturel or a Pet Nat of Cayuga 2021. This wine is super small production. It is, I think, best gotten from the Barry Family website. That's barryfamilywines.com for $26 per bottle.
We should open it now.
Yes. Yes,
let
we should.
Let's do that.
Let's pop it.
No, I've had mine refrigerated. Is that the correct protocol? This is, appears white-ish.
Yep, you got it.
Oh, boy. Oh, wow. That aroma is fragrant from a good, I would say, 12 inches from my nose. It announced itself when that cap came off.
A powerful intensity of aromas.
Oh, boy. That smells horrible. All right. I got a healthy pour here. I didn't eat breakfast yet. This is going to be a bad day.
I also did not eat breakfast.
Oh, good.
We're setting ourselves up real well.
Oh, God. Oh, it smells terrible. What is that? So it's cat pee. This is like the telltale stink of cat pee. It's 100% cat pee. There's also something medicinal. What is that?
Is it like a cough drop kind of thing?
Kind of. Yeah, there's like a burn, like an antiseptic burn almost.
It's like Tussin. It's like Robo.
It smells like iodine.
Mmm.
Smells like candied pineapple a little bit.
Yep.
And
like dried apricot.
Yeah, and like dusty attic.
Yep.
Ooh. Yeah, and some kind of horrible burn, like rusty radiator heating up stink. Oh.
Scott is, as we all know, an accomplished sommelier and is doing a very good job of selling this wine.
You're here for the sales pitch, all right? I'm not here for the SponCon. I don't work for the producers, Jamie. I don't need to sell it. I'm just calling it like I'm seasoning it. I ain't even tasted it yet. Oh, whoa. This is a provocation, sir.
I am not trying to provoke you necessarily, although I am trying to... Like, we should talk about all of the flavors in here, all of the aromas, and why he's doing his stinky cat face. Scotty hates it. So, on the palate, what do you
getting? there's like a it reminds me of, I don't know, like an emergency packet.
Okay.
You know, like the little baggie of vitamins and shit when you're fighting off a cold, like an emergency packet in too little water, plus an Alka-Seltzer, which was often my, like, I have a cold, but I can't stop working thing. That was a cocktail for me. It's got that fizz and that burn. And the cat pee is really hard to ignore, Jamie. How are you just powering through this shit with all the cat pee?
I find this to be delicious.
There's I don't know, something oily in the back of the throat. There's a weird textural thing as I'm swallowing. There is a citrus thing. The citrus is in there, but it's like lemons gone bad. I don't know, man. What are you getting that you're liking in this?
I like the whole thing. Like as you I'm don't fucking roll your eyes at me. Roll this whole head at me.
I like the whole thing.
No, but like you're picking apart all of the small notes, and I enjoy the sum, like the cat pee or the rustiness or the like Robitussin kind of thing. Like individually, not great, but the sum of all the parts tastes to me very, very much akin to like a great lambic or goose, like some of the good sour beers of the world. This is like definitely more in that realm of flavor profile, which is divisive. Not everyone likes it.
Yeah, I'm not much for a sour beer.
I know you're not. This is what we would call very funky natty. You know, this is a 00. We didn't add anything. We just fermented it. We left your stink face, dude. You're being super dramatic.
We didn't even check what it tasted like. We just put it in bottles and shipped it out there. We don't vouch for it. We don't know if it's good. If it's terrible, we'll throw it out. We won't drink it. We take zero accountability for what we're doing here.
I mean, there's plenty of accountability. The guy's name is on the damn bottle.
Is it his real name?
Mm-hmm. Ian Barry. So like, I very much enjoy the fruit components. I very much enjoy the parts that come through that are identifiable as this particular grape, Cayuga, that sort of that grilled pineapple thing or candied pineapple, which you identified. It's a little gingery. It's a little anisey.
Chewable vitamin. There's a note of that in there. Is that come from Cayuga? But it's like not the purple Freds. It's the red Barneys.
Mm.
That chewable vitamin.
That was an obscure pull, and I wonder if the Freds are actually purple and the Barneys are actually red. Is this a thing you remember, or that you just like pulled out of your ass?
I do remember there were distinct, and there were orange ones too. Were the Dinos orange?
The Dinos might have been orange, or maybe it was
the Freds Wilma? Were orange. I don't know, but there was an orange one as well, and I specifically vividly remember the taste of that. It's kind of like if you chewed one of those up. Or like a whole fistful of them, but not the purple ones, just the red ones, maybe the orange ones, because you got to get the citrus notes in there. If you chewed up a bunch of those and then as you were swallowing it, you vomited back into your mouth. It's kind of like that a little bit. It's like Flintstones chewable vitamins with fermented citrus and bile.
Okay.
I find this really perverse, dude.
So this may be the wine that you hate the most that we've ever done.
I don't know about the most. I mean, it's up there. It's top five for sure. It's up there with the one sherry, but maybe not the other sherry. And I don't know all the other things I didn't like that you served. The other cappy ones.
This one is maybe provoking the most creative response.
Ugh.
You're really going in on flavor profile.
Ugh. There's a lot of very loud notes here.
It is. It's very candied in its flavor profile. And I think you're identifying that with the, like, alongside the medicinal component, which is what is leading you to Flintstones chewable vitamins. There's something that feels kind of artificial about it. Anyway.
Yeah.
I find this wine to be, you know, exciting and delicious. I understand why you don't like it. I was kind of anticipating this response. I wasn't anticipating the strength of it. And now you seem to be sad. Now you're just upset. Do you want to go get yourself some whiskey to drink for the rest of the episode?
I might want something else. But it's all like, it's not uninteresting. It is interesting to
me. There's a lot going on.
What would compel someone to make this and then upon drinking it, not to despair, but instead to sell it at market and to be seemingly successful doing so? Like, how does something so complexly awful become palatable to many people?
Well, it's...
Oh.
I'm having a really good time.
All right.
With how much you hate this.
Hang on.
What?
Let's just check.
Okay.
If this bottle was fucked, what would it taste and smell like to you? Let's just rule it out.
Okay. Scott, you've been describing you've been describing this spot on. There's nothing that you're saying that I'm contesting.
So why do you like all of these horrible things?
Because I have a taste for more extreme flavors.
Like cat pee,
and like
regurgitated vitamins.
The one thing that I don't think you're identifying here that I think is very present is like a barnyard. You know, like a fresh, like a horse field, and there's some horse poops around.
What? I think the one thing you're really overlooking here, this really delightful note that is totally elevating the entire profile for
manure,
is the flavor of horse shit. You have to imagine the potpourri of today's and yesterday's and the stallions and the mares and all the aromas of all of that shit coming together really takes this cat pee wine to a whole nother transcendent level.
Are you done?
How is this a sales point?
It's not a sale. I'm not trying to sell you on it. Obviously, you hate it. Like, I'm telling you that I like it. I like the barnyard of it all. I like the medicinal nature of it. I like the candied fruit character of it. I like the extremely high acidity, the effervescent bubbles, the aromatic interest. These are all the things that I like about it. I find it quaffable and refreshing.
You find it quaffable?
Quaffable.
Whew.
Able to be quaffed.
What? And quaff to you means what exactly? What do you think quaff means? I am now curious.
To quaff. To sate one's thirst.
So you're saying to drink?
Yeah.
You find it drinkable?
Mm-hmm. Quaffable sounds better, though.
Well done. Are we done with tasting notes? Are there other animal waste products that you would like to favorably liken this wine to?
No, just well, horses and cows. You know, not just horses. Cows. No, just like a bunch of other fruits. We didn't talk about apples or like, I think this also tastes like grape candy, you know, the artificial grape candy.
I do see the apple thing there.
Yeah. You know, like a really tart green apple. But we'll talk about all these flavor notes and sort of what is winemaking, what is the grape, and then eventually we'll, you know, I'll get on my soapbox and talk about why hybrids are important.
We're actually gonna do what is winemaking? That's so broad.
No. What is winemaking? What flavor wise is a result of winemaking versus what is a result of the fruit itself?
I'd be very curious to find out what things in here a person did on purpose.
Oh, none very of it curious. Was done on purpose. This was all just like throw it into a vat and let it go.
So is it the result of winemaking then? Apparently well, not. Well,
the winemaking is like kind of unintentional and intentionally unintentional.
This is like that, what's his name? The piece of experimental music that's 4 minutes and 13 seconds long and it's just silent. But there's an entire orchestra on stage and they do nothing for 4 minutes and 13 seconds.
It's like that. Exactly.
Lydia references it in Tar.
Linda.
Whatever, Jamie. All right. This is gross. Mission impossible. Can I drink another glass of this stuff before
your mission? Should you choose to accept it? Finish this bottle.
From bum, bum, bum. So we don't have to do like a ton of background on the series.
The people know what the missions are.
It's been nigh on 30 years, since the first one in 1996. It's Mission Impossible. It is an espionage action thriller franchise starring Tom Cruise, as Impossible Mission Force super spy Ethan Hunt. The first movie in 96 was a huge turning point in Cruise's career. It was his first time producing. He built a franchise specifically for and around himself, which we will and can talk about. The first six entries in the series made over $3.5 billion at the global box office. And again, as of this recording, the new one, Dead Reckoning Part 1, has been in theaters for like 2 days. But before I get into any of my shit, Jamie, we both just did the Mission Marathon. We watched them all in short succession.
Yes.
I have never done that before. I know that 4 and 5 were new to you, and you were surprised to find out that 6, Fallout, was not new to you.
Which I had watched during fall of 2020 when I was just unconscious the whole time, I guess.
Seemingly, yeah, which is scandalous to me.
But I do remember the movie. If you had told me like the plot points of the movie, I would have been like, oh, fuck, I did see that.
Yeah.
But I didn't when I had convinced myself that I had just not seen any of the 4, 5, or 6.
You fool, because you missed out. You were missing out for years on the good stuff.
I was.
On that good stuff. But yeah, what was your experience watching them in a compressed time? Because I found it very revealing, and I found like narratives kind of revealing themselves to me between the movies. And it was fascinating just to watch Fallout or Fallout is 2018. The new one is 2023.
Yep.
Going back to 96. I mean, you're talking 27 years of like movie history and changes in how things are made and done and styled. What were your thoughts? Give me your impressions.
So 1 and 3, the experience was largely like a comfort food experience, as we have gone through, you know, with this miniseries. I remember when we saw Mission Impossible 3 in theaters, together. Like, we were all pretty pumped on it. We loved P. Hoff and his performance and just the whole, like, the bombacity of the whole movie. And I still, like, retain that. It's kind of a skeletal movie, but it's filled in with a lot of fun performance.
Mm-hmm.
And one, I just love watching Mission Impossible 1. It's so much fun. And there's a lot of, like, interpersonal dynamics, and there's a lot of, like, revealing how they do things. And I just find it to be every beat and every, like, weird angle that the camera is at, like the weird up angle on Kittredge in, you know, Kittredge, you haven't seen me very upset.
Yeah. The new movie tries to do that, but, like, Chris McQuarrie, who I think is a great director, like, he's not Brian De Palma, who directed the first Mission Impossible. And so De Palma gets away with, like, the craziest low angle Dutch angles you ever saw on two people. But it works to, like, heighten the tension and the paranoia. And in the big Kittredge Ethan scene early on in the new movie, it's like, well, we can't think of crazy angles like that, so we're just going to try a bunch of different bad angles and cut them together poorly. And it will actually kind of undercut the tension, I thought, a little bit. I was a little frustrated by that scene.
I was less frustrated by it because I don't know. I just kind of took it as a callback and let it be that.
Yeah.
But I understand, and, like, on rewatch probably would reflect your frustration with it.
Mm.
Then two was just like, oh yeah, this is as, like, kind of mediocre and not as much fun as it was when I watched it fucking 20 years ago or whatever.
When you were 14 and you were stupid and had bad taste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like I've always known that two was the weak link of the first trilogy, right? But when it came out, it was exciting and it was big and whatever. And watching it again, I was like, oh, this is nothing.
It's so dumb.
It's very stupid.
Yeah.
There's nothing going on.
Yeah. It's a real vanity project.
And was it you or was it Chris in our group chat that was calling it a midlife crisis?
That was me. I am not the first person to describe it that way.
Okay.
But yeah, MI2 is 100% a midlife crisis.
And then 4 through 7 was a wild ride. Like, 6 excluded because I had seen it before, and watching it again was largely like remembering the plot and what had happened and all of the things. But, like, 4, 5, and 7 was like just more cohesive than 1 through 3 ever was.
It actually feels like a film series, whereas the first three are like three disconnected movies that share a star, a character name, and a theme song.
And I kind of like that a little. Like, I would have preferred a little bit more of that and a little bit less through line.
A little bit less of the, well, it's not even that there's a through line. It's that there is a tonal continuity that the others do not have. There is a tonal and stylistic continuity, starting with Ghost, but then really cementing with the three McQuarrie movies.
Yeah, that was the part of it that I liked them a lot. But if there was a part that I rebelled against that I didn't like, it was that. And I think it's probably because of my baggage with the fucking MCU and just not liking the sameness of it all.
Yeah, but that's, like, I get it.
I know that they're different things, Scott. I recognize that.
Right, but it's like, I get it, and it would be fun if the Mission series had stuck to what was seemingly the original game plan, which was it would just be like a different auteur would come in and Cruise would only work with, like, the most serious people. And then, you know, by the third movie, it's a fucking J.J. Abrams' debut feature. Like, that plan had gone out the window. And, like, so I know that they're all this largely similar after that. But on the other hand, like, Ghost Protocol, Rogue Nation, Fallout, and I think a little bit to a lesser extent, Dead Reckoning Part 1, like, offer astonishing next level action. And what they're essentially like an incubator for a kind of a different way of doing like live action, big budget action filmmaking, which is kind of like steering from the hip a little bit. And the results have been largely transcendent. So like, I don't like, yes, it would be nice if this series was still as diverse and divergent and stylish as it was in the beginning. But also like the highs are so fucking high now that I can't really complain that there is a uniformity that happens to work with the way that they keep trying to take action filmmaking to the next level in terms of storytelling and production and post-production.
Talk a little bit more about that. Like what are the things that they are doing that are raising the bar and that have been used elsewhere?
So it starts with just the De Palma movie, right?
Yeah.
And then Brian De Palma, who at that point was like in sort of a career lull, but he had started in the mid to late 70s doing horror films and suspense films. He made Carrie. He had a big hit in the late 80s with The Untouchables, but he's mostly known for these like horned up, like the subtext is the text, like Hitchcock homages, pastiches, like Body Double or what's the one? With Michael Caine. Oh, it's going to bug me.
With Michael Caine.
Anyway, we don't need to talk forever about Brian De Palma. So he does that one. And then John Woo, like his next big movie after, I guess, Face Off, should be huge. Like he's at a career high. And then J.J. Abrams kind of comes in and does the third one. And he's just a TV guy. And then you have Chris McQuarrie come in. McQuarrie came in as a writer. He's a script doctor a lot of the times. He has an Oscar because in 1995, he wrote The Usual Suspects and won an Oscar when he was like not even 30 yet. And then got put in director jail after his 1999 or 2000 complete flop, The Way of the Gun, came out.
Which we love.
I have great affection for it. I haven't watched it since this second stage of McQuarrie's career. So like I'm a little gun shy. He only speaks unfavorably about it and the failures he owns. But so he couldn't get another project made after that movie. He was toxic, but he could work as a script doctor. And so Paramount brings him in on Ghost Protocol, which had gone into production with a script that they weren't happy with and was unfinished. They did all of their location filming and then they had to come back and they were shooting somewhere in North America, I think in Canada. Yeah, doing sound stages, doing a handful of shots for the Burge scene, doing some reshoots and shooting all of their interiors. And so they bring McQuarrie in and the first thing he says is, show me everything you've already shot, because that's what I'm married to. And so he watches everything they had filmed thus far. And he was like, all right, so here's the story that I see that's already here. And here are additional things you would need to film to bridge the gaps, because you've already done basically almost all of your set pieces and everything. And that kind of becomes the way, that's like the baseline for how they make these mission movies, which is now McQuarrie directing 5 and then being the first director invited back to do 6 to do Fallout. And now he's done back to back Dead Reckoning Part 1 and presumably next year, although maybe not, Part 2. The thing that he and Cruise keep iterating on working together is this idea that you let the movie tell you what it is and you don't resist it, even in the middle of filming a scene. They like openly admit now that, which is the thing that like a lot of like big action movies, they're reverse engineered from what are the set pieces we want to do, right? Which is kind of like how action cinema has always been driven, like what, not what characters or what story do I want to tell, but like I want to do a car chase. I want to do a foot chase. I want to do a big fight. I want to do a shootout. Right. So the mission movies, like they openly embrace now that reverse engineered thinking. And so they build out all their set pieces. They figure out what is the emotional arc and like the kinetic arc of intensity of all those set pieces. What's the best order for them? And then what things are we thinking about with our characters that would justify them to go through all these hoops to do all this crazy shit in a couple of days? And then those motivations can change during filming. And they're open to it and they allow it to happen. It seems like they had kind of a difficult production on Rogue Nation where they were like, you know, with all that budget on the line, they were like, well, we've got to make changes, but we don't know how to do it. But McQuarrie seems to have a brain where he can see the ripples And so if he's like, well, if we change this character's motivation here, it's going to be a problem in the next couple of scenes. And how are we going to fix that? Do we reshoot something that we already shot, or do we reinterpret it or repurpose something else? And so like, they're like flying by the seat of their pants. They just told a story on Light the Fuse, the Mission Impossible podcast, about during the filming of Fallout, Vanessa Kirby, who plays the White Widow, the first scene that she filmed is the scene in Paris after the big chase. And they had a completely different backstory for like Ethan's persona at that point in the story, who his cover was going to be infiltrating and getting in with her. And her performance was so specific and interesting that they realized, oh, this does not work with the backstory that we came up with. So they scrapped the whole thing. And realized, all right, well, that means in a couple of weeks when we shoot this scene and this scene and this scene, we'll need to have rewritten it and to figure out a thing that makes it better. And they just follow it. And it sounds chaotic and terrifying, but like it's a weird way to make these things at this budget level. It's different from the Marvel way, which is like, we'll just film a bunch of shit and then we'll fix it all in post. Like these guys are like, we're going to go in with a loose plan and we're okay with changing that. And if we change it, we'll figure it out on the day while we're doing it.
I like it. Is this an approach that has had effect? Like, are other people doing it? Because you mentioned that it's like, you know, has had an impact on the industry.
No. I think the impact is that the movies are so fucking good.
Okay.
Like the impact is that style and that like audience emotional reaction, like, but also flexibility in terms of writing and storytelling. You see it in like, you know, last year's big honking hit in Top Gun Maverick, which McQuarrie is a writer and executive producer on. Like the two of them are a team, and like that's the thing, that's the bummer about, like you were talking about, preferring the diversity of directors and styles in the earlier half of the Mission series. But like now you get a continuity and a consistency, but the team of the two of them is what is making the franchise so incredibly good and like so vibrant right now.
I still prefer the diversity of the beginning of the series. Like that was the thing that I thought was special about Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
That was like the big thing. And now there's like, you know, not only is there like a visual continuity and as you say, a continuity of like production style or whatever, but also there is story continuity, which didn't exist prior to McQuarrie coming on.
Yeah.
They were fully self-contained like things.
There's not even a ton. It's actually something I was kind of hoping for more from Dead Rec Part 1. I was hoping for a little bit more story, not story continuity, but I really want that relationship with Ethan and Ilsa to pay off.
Which it didn't.
Which it doesn't.
At all.
They do different things. But yeah, I wouldn't mind a little more continuity. Like I like that these movies essentially are all always the exact same thing, no matter what the style is. Like there is a formula and they are largely self-contained with very tiny references. And the only thing that makes it more like a conventional franchise is that now the series has a recurring cast.
Right. And I think that maybe with a little bit more continuity, on reflection on Seven, one of my big problems with it is their reliance on this idea of like, we are friends and we love each other. Like, aren't you just,
they're friends. They love each other.
Sure. But
they
like
put each other, they put their lives on the line for each other all the time.
Yes.
Ethan tells Benji where to go, or Benji tells Ethan where to go. He says, go left or go right.
Right. But when do they interact as friends and not as professional colleagues?
They had that beer one time at the end of Ghost Protocol.
Sure.
And so I think they probably do that after every mission. They get a beer somewhere. Yeah.
That note did not land at all for me because they're like, you are professional secret agents. Isn't the whole thing to be clandestine and not form attachments? Like, isn't that why there's like a reunion moment whenever the team comes back together?
Yeah.
Because we haven't seen each other since the previous mission. And how do you... Do you just not have any interpersonal relationships that are above surface level? Is that the thing?
So I think looking to the series where people wear rubber masks of other people's faces and Tom Cruise hangs on the outside of airplanes, if we're looking to that for like genuine interpersonal dynamics and relatable human behavior, or
I'm not
looking,
looking
for real
for,
people
I'm not
beneath
looking
the surface,
for it, Scott.
Let me finish.
I'm not then looking for it.
We are looking in the wrong place.
The seventh movie posits that it exists. I wasn't looking for it, but in the concept of I put my friends above all else, the seventh movie begs you to think about that.
All right. You don't know what begs the question means, and I think you should stop using it.
I didn't say begs the question.
It
first
begs
of all.
You to think of it. You were dabbling in a begs the question.
Sure, in that
misappropriation.
Area. But it says it out loud. These are my friends, and I put them above all else.
But that's in the text of the series. Like so much of 5 and 6 are about Ethan's refusal to let one of his team die,
sure.
Even if letting them die would make accomplishing the mission easier,
but
or
now
sooner.
But now we're extending that to Benji as Ooh. Well as Luther.
Yeah, because they've spent time together. They've spent a lot of time together. Presumably these are not the only missions that they have done. They've probably done other missions together. It seems like they're a regular team.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. Jamie, you've never had work friends who you thought of as real friends?
Of course I have. Of course I have, Scott, but we've also like had interactions outside of work. And I'm saying that the setup here
wow.
is like specifically not that.
Wow. This is the Jamiest nitpick I've ever seen. I wish they spent more time going out and like, you know, going to restaurants and maybe going to wine bars and asking Hassan what he would recommend.
If you're gonna drop something about like we have this grand relationship, there should be a grand relationship. And there just isn't.
I think the friendships are there. I think they are sketched out over the course of the series, just in the behaviors and the way that they react to each other and how they want to save and help each other.
All right. I'll give you that in 3, there is significant, like, I care about you, buddy energy between Luther and Ethan.
There's
like,
that.
There's a bunch.
It's in 4 as well. It's in their lovely scene at the bar. In 4 at the end when Luther is there and Ethan's like, I'll get the drinks. And Luther gets up and gives him the finger. He's like, yeah, I know you were. I wasn't reaching for my wallet. It's there in 5 when Luther comes up and he threatens Jeremy Renner. He's like, if I think for a second that you might betray Ethan. And he just like cocks one eyebrow under his pork pie hat. He loves Ethan. And so does Benji. Ethan saves him like multiple times. They have a great affection and respect for one another.
All right.
So like I think the relationships are there. I think they're there. Just because they don't all go to fucking happy hour together.
I'm skeptical, Scott.
Can I talk about something that I find fascinating?
I would encourage you to do that.
Good. So something that watching these movies in a very compressed time frame has illuminated for me is something that's been like percolating in the back of my head, and I've read like other critics talk about this, but the twin arcs of the Ethan Hunt character I find fascinating. And watching 27 years of movies in the span of 8 days kind of like really draws that out for you.
Twin arcs?
The twin arcs. So on the one hand, you have the arc of Ethan Hunt, who is just a blank slate cipher. He is an avatar for what Tom Cruise wants us to think about him.
Right.
Right. Like, remember, like, this is 1996. This is the peak of Tom Cruise's star power. He is producing his first movie and launching his own franchise and building it around him. And he picks Mission Impossible, inserts his Ethan Hunt character into it, destroys any of the returning characters or, like, you know, like Jim Phelps, the John Voight character,
right.
Is the hero of the Mission Impossible TV series that ran for like 6 years. So, like, Cruise is taking this, putting himself into it and deciding how he wants to be depicted and thought of. So in the first movie, he shows you Ethan Hunt growing up, essentially. Like, this is Tom Cruise growing up on screen in front of us. He's not the wisecracking, hotshot, chewing gum like Maverick. He becomes a seasoned, strategic, capable man by the end of the first movie. And that is what Hunt is putting out there for us. MI2 is reminding you how hot and cool and definitely straight Tom Cruise is. Every moment of that movie, women find him desirable. He is extremely cool. He does dope shit. He wears dope clothes. And he definitely only fucks women.
Yes.
But romantically. The third one, this movie comes out a year after Cruise's 2005 new publicity team tanks his reputation with the Oprah couch thing and with him going like very vocal about Scientology, which he'd never done before. So the third one comes out a year after all that, and it's about showing you how definitely normal and down-to-earth Tom Cruise is. He's not a super spy anymore. He's a regular, marryable guy now. He's got a wife. She's hot and cool, and she'd fuck him, so he's probably normal, right? He can throw a party. He's very casual and interesting. He can't be that weird. And then Ghost Protocol, and this begins the Macquarie phase. But this is the second phase of Ethan as Cruise avatardom, where Ethan's personality and personal life are de-emphasized. And instead, what we focus on is his intensity, always very intense, his determination, his virtuosity, and his huge, swollen, calamitous balls.
Calamitous balls.
They're very dangerous to other people. This new Ethan is a veteran. He'll always get the job done his way, which is invariably complicated and more expensive than the other way. And it's thrilling and nobody sees it but him, but he's always right. And it's still just a Tom Cruise avatar. Missions 4 through 7, Ethan is Ethan as Cruise, showing the studios that movie stars are still relevant. That he is the only one who can do what he does, and that if they just get the fuck out of his way, everything would be fine. Top Gun Maverick is also about this. So like the character is a blank slate of nothingness with very little defining character traits on paper. And he's just a series of like, you know, Cruise going through his different eras of what he wants to be accepted as.
Okay. That is interesting. That read on it, and it's not a thing that I'm not conscious of, which is to say it is a thing that I am conscious of.
There we go. Okay, good.
Makes me like these movies less. It's not, yeah. I don't like it. I don't like Tom Cruise. Like, Cruise sucks.
Yeah, do we have to do this, though? I did want to do a disclaimer at the beginning of the episode, and I forgot, which
we
is
should
just
do a little bit of, like, Tom Cruise sucks.
Jamie, we don't need to virtue signal.
Have we done it?
We did it when we talked about Edge of Tomorrow.
I forgot about that.
We talked about it a lot. So if you're curious on our Tom Cruise takes, TCCs, TCTs.
TCTs, TM.
I did not have breakfast, and this horrible wine is hitting me good.
It's only 10.1% alcohol, Scott.
Anyway, we discussed it before in our Edge of Tomorrow episode, way back in our End of the World miniseries, but suffice it to say, we are aware of all the bad things that Scientology does. We are aware that Cruise is, at best, an unwitting beneficiary of those bad things, but more likely much worse than that.
Oh, yeah, he is leadership. Let's be real.
And he sounds like a total stone cold weirdo, and I certainly wouldn't want to be married or related to him.
Or in the same space.
Yeah. So
really,
I do not,
at any time.
Not putting the man on a pedestal, but like I still enjoy his works. And until he is like fully and undeniably canceled, which I'm sure is gonna happen at some point, I am still going to largely guilt-free enjoy Mission Impossible movies.
Well, that's the thing that I'm getting at here is, yeah, like the more I think about, or the less I think about Tom Cruise when I'm watching the Missions Impossible or any Tom Cruise performance, the better.
It's pretty difficult because all these movies are just about Tom Cruise.
Yeah. No shit.
Yeah.
Which became more and more difficult as I got through, you know, 4, 5, 6 and then 7.
Well, Jamie, this podcast isn't called Mission Difficult. It's Mission Impossible.
God damn it.
Can I make it better for you? Because there is also a second arc to the Ethan Hunt character.
Okay.
Which is the unspoken arc of Ethan Hunt in the films.
Go on.
All right. So I will try to do this quickly. In the first movie, he's an adrenaline junkie hotshot who loses his whole team. Then, in response probably to his entire team being murdered and some of it being his fault, in a crazy overreaction, he turns himself into an adrenaline junkie lone wolf who wears like leather and sunglasses all the time. He tries to be a dirty dick James Bond, reluctantly falls for the first woman he sent to recruit, and then does a bunch of crazy shit rather than just let her die, which would have led to mission accomplished. Then, again, he hugely course corrects into a domesticated house husband type who trains the new agent, but then he gets drawn back into the field when one of his team is killed. Remember, Jamie, he hates when that happens. And then he helplessly watches, he thinks, his wife get executed in front of him. And at the end of that movie, he is clinically dead for a full minute. And so when he comes back from the dead, and I'm being very specific in those word uses, when he comes back from the dead for the first time at the end of Mission Impossible 3, something has snapped. And I think he's a different person after that. Ghost Protocol, once again, he's lone wolfing it, right? He's in the prison. He went there rather than let his wife be in danger. He gets reluctantly released and drawn into a team. He really takes a leadership role for the first time in a significant way in Ghost Protocol. And he kind of like turns into the IMF's hot dad slash starting quarterback slash cheerleader. Then at the end of Rogue, spending most of that movie being basically the same guy from Ghost Protocol, near the end of Rogue, he dies again. And when he comes back, this is when he starts the, it'll work out. I don't know how, but just trust me, it'll work out. Insanity, that is the driving motivating factor for this character for the rest of Rogue, all of Fallout, and all of Dead Reckoning. Oh, and also something that no one talks about is that in Mission Impossible Fallout, Ethan Hunt starts having prescient or precognitive dreams. And it is never discussed that I think that dying twice gives him the ability to see the future.
So you're talking about his like his arc, but also his escalating abilities.
Well, so his escalating abilities are a separate thing. That is the only on paper arc the character has in the actual movies, is that he gets more skills over time. And otherwise, he doesn't really change too much, unless if you try to fill in the narrative, as I just did, of the gaps between the movies. Why is he radically different? And where do these major behavior changes come from?
Right.
That are otherwise not addressed. They never talk about how the Ethan Hunt of Mission Impossible 2 in no way resembles the guy from 1 or the guy from 3.
Yep.
Who in no way really resemble each other, except that they all look like Tom Cruise.
Because they are Tom Cruise.
Yeah. But yeah, he dreams of the future twice in Fallout, and it's just never mentioned at all. And you could say that it's, you know, it's a little poetic liberty or poetic license in the movie, but like, no, he straight up dreams of the future 2 times.
I was hoping for the precog abilities to continue in 7.
I was hoping there was more precog abilities. I was hoping there was more. All right, so let's do it. Let's just do it, Jamie. Of the many, 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 many abilities of Ethan Hunt, do you have a favorite?
I thought about this a little bit, and I think that my favorite, just because it's the most fun to watch on screen, is nope. It's not the running.
It's not the running because the running.
The running's fun.
The running is very super exciting. Fun,
but Ethan's ability to be essentially a bouncy ball, to fall, to get hit, to bounce off of a thing and not be hurt.
And just be fine. Yeah. He's got Homer Simpson syndrome.
I think possibly the best one is in the beginning of Rogue Nation when he gets onto the plane.
Very violently.
And then Benji opens the wrong door first and then the right door. And when he opens the right door, Ethan gets sucked into the plane
and bounces off a bulkhead.
Against the opposite side, and you're like, how the fuck? Like, you would, with that velocity, you would have not just broken bones, but broken skin.
Yeah.
You would be bleeding all the fuck over the place, and he just fucking bounces.
Yeah, he's a Looney Tune. That is something I really liked in the new one, is how cartoony it felt, and how much it was like Looney Tunes escalation of gags. Like a lot of the stuff on the train felt very Looney Tunes-y to me.
Can we take a moment?
Some of the car stuff was very Looney Tunes-y to me. So your favorite power is his imperviousness to physical harm.
Correct. Yes. Okay. What about you?
I mean, there's so many. Like I did in this rewatch, I ended up writing all of them down. But I think my favorite, so it is never said out loud, but Ethan has a photographic memory, yes, which becomes a plot point in Rogue Nation because he memorizes all the accounts that Lane wants from the fucking red box, right? Yep. But it actually, the first time it appears is in Ghost Protocol. It was Ethan after the Kremlin gets blown up, and now he's in the limo with Tom Wilkinson and Jeremy Renner, and he borrows a pen, and he draws on the palm of his hand a drawing of the character played by, God, what's his name? Is it? No, that's his character's name.
The character's name is Lane Solomon.
No. I'm talking about Ghost Pro. They are blurring together in your
sorry.
Brain.
Sorry, they are.
The Cobalt, the villain in Ghost Protocol.
Whatever his name is.
His name is Michael Nyquist. That's him. He does a sketch of that guy on his hand with like a ballpoint pen very quickly, holds his hand up. Very good likeness of the man. So good that Jeremy Renner's analyst is able to look at it and say, yes, I believe that this is the man that you have drawn there. And then that ability comes up again in 5 when after the CIA has seized Ethan's possessions from like one of his safe houses and they take his hand drawings of Ilsa and of Solomon Lane, the villain. And these drawings are so good that Luther is able to plug them into a global facial recognition system and get a match within moments.
Yep.
That might be my favorite of his abilities because it is so dumb. And like, for what job did he need to learn that ability for? Right? You figure all of them he picked up for a specific mission. Like, I got to learn I need to do halo drops for this one mission, so I'll learn how to do it. Or I need to do sleight of hand magic or whatever. Photo accurate portrait drawing. What kind of scenario did that come up in?
He was undercover as a carnival caricature portraitist. And
you know what? That's as good of an answer as you're going to get.
Thank you.
He spent like a 36-hour crash course with a portrait artist master and learned all of his skills. Because Ethan's also like an autodidact or something.
I would pay money to see an Ethan Hunt sequence where he's like tracking someone down at a carnival as a caricature artist.
Or like Ethan has to like learn to become like a marionette, like puppeteer. And he's like super fucking good at it. And then he uses the like puppet to fight bad guys away.
He's the guy at the like dart throwing booth where you have to like break the balloons or whatever. Yeah, and he uses sleight of hand to break the balloons like for someone or like to catch a thing out of the air and nobody notices or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Ethan, that dumb shit that I'm here for.
Ethan Impossible, the fallow years, the low period. Like what if he went rogue and it actually stuck for a while and he just had to get like a day job?
What does Ethan Hunt do for a day job?
I don't know. Like anything, he's good at everything.
Yeah.
There's nothing he's bad at.
That is true.
Right? He never tries anything and fails. He maybe fails a little bit and then succeeds.
And then ends up succeeding in some way. Yeah.
He's quite accomplished. Can I just read to you just from
go
from,
through it
from my
from
list
from beginning to end? You've got this whole list here.
I've got a whole list here, and it's in chronological order. So in the first film, we meet Ethan, and he is just generally athletic. He's a very fast runner. He has gymnastic flexibility. He's good at mimicry, acting. He's a world class actor. That Ethan Hunt. He's a better actor than Tom Cruise was.
Got him.
He's a strategist, and he demonstrates sleight of hand magic. In the second movie, we add free climbing, seduction, small arms mastery, martial arts, base jumping, and precision driving of cars and motorcycles. Third movie, credit to Johnny Wirtz for pointing this out, hostcraft. Ethan Hunt throws a very, very good party with his soon-to-be wife. It looked like a
fun party to be at.
And he was like getting the ice and making small talk and dancing with people. People seemed like they were having a great time. He's a very good party host. Also lip reading. He does trigonometry and physics calculations on a window.
On a window. Super dope scene. Yep.
His running gets an upgrade in Mission Impossible 3. He goes to like level 2 super running in MI3.
He does.
And this is the first time that he has a resurrection. Ghost Protocol, we add escape artistry. The first time that we reveal the photographic memory, And also portrait drawing is where that comes up. Rogue Nation, the photographic memory gets an upgrade by memorizing all those bank account codes. He resurrects a second time, and we add the extended breath holds.
Yeah.
Did you know that for the movie, for all the training, Tom Cruise trained and learned to be able to hold his breath for 6 minutes?
Jesus Christ.
And they said, that's not realistic. Like, audiences aren't going to believe that. Let's just say it's three, and then when Ethan runs out after three, it'll be super suspenseful. But yeah, he could actually do it for six.
Well, he could sit there for 6 minutes.
Right, yeah. The athleticism is a different thing. Yeah.
Right, and they make a point of telling you that in the movie.
Right, yeah, the expenditure of energy. And then in Fallout, we add halo jumping, helicopter combat, his prescient dreaming, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do Dead Reckoning Part 1. We'll do our hot takes, our blistering yeah. takes from last night. But in Dead Reckoning, he adds a few new skills, including horse mastery.
Yep.
Because he doesn't just ride that horse. He gets it to do the lay down thing.
Which is insane.
Yeah. In a desert. Horse mastery, desert navigation, and survival. Don't think yep. we should overlook that. He does a tiny bit of pickpocketing, and he flies a type of parachute called a speed wing. We've seen him do base jumping and parachuting before, but never this speed wing thing looked very specific and kind of terrifying.
Sure.
Yeah.
It absolutely did. There was a lot of spinning that seemed yeah. very disorienting.
Did I miss any of his powers or abilities? I feel like I'm overlooking something.
I mean, you didn't mention his imperviousness to harm.
That is true. I hadn't really, until you mentioned it, I hadn't really considered that on the list of Ethan Hunt superpowers.
The man is a bouncy ball.
Yeah, he doesn't really. He gets like seriously hurt one time in the fight in the vertical parking garage in India at the end of Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
His leg gets kind of fucked up, and then he drives a car off the thing.
But, yeah, but he falls from that, significant heights.
He does. That ending is fantastic. That whole fight in the garage is so stupid, but it's so much fun.
Yep.
Yeah, genuinely horrifying, too. But yeah, so Deadly Rex.
Deadly Rex. So yeah. I would like to start
yes.
with the much ballyhooed, like, big motorcycle jump.
The thing that they have been hyping for 6 months... a thing that takes place, has less than 1 minute of screen time, and yet before Avatar The Way of Water, we saw a 9-minute IMAX preview just explaining how the stunt is done.
Correct.
This is how they do, Jamie. You've been missing out on this, but since Ghost Prot, Paramount has realized that you can sell these movies with a couple of good trailers, having everybody do all the press ever, because it's like a movie like this, they spend $100 million to market it, which is insane.
Fucking insanity.
But so they do all the regular marketing stuff, and they emphasize one stunt with lots of behind the scenes footage and emphasizing how Cruise is doing it himself. They did it with the Burj in Ghost Prot. They did it with him hanging on the outside of the A500 at the beginning of Rogue Nation. And they did it with the helicopter piloting in Fallout, which is all real, and him doing his own piloting that he spent like a year to get certified so he could do all the flying in that sequence.
That's fucking wild.
Which is the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in a movie, that helicopter yep. sequence. So terrifying. But so yeah, for this one, they drum up the marketing machine for the big bike jump.
And I think the big difference, like, I didn't even know about the marketing for the previous ones, but the big difference here is it's 1 minute of screen time in...
Yeah.
In Dead Reckoning, it's like barely a showstopper. Like, it's exciting, but I don't know. I've thought about it since last night, and like, what if we stayed with Ethan that whole time?
Yeah.
Like, I get the value of the, like, him crash.
Oh, and how about?
We're in spoiler territory.
We're in spoiler territory.
Big spoiler territory.
But if you haven't seen the movie, switch off now. If plot spoilers are important to you, we're doing it. So you've been warned.
Be warned, all ye who enter here.
Be warned.
But like, we see him jump off of we see him do a lot of like thinking about how he's going to get down off this mountain.
Yeah, jump the bike off the mountain. How am I going to parachute without crashing into the wall? How am I going to steer to land on the moving train?
How am I going to get away from the mountain? Great, we love it. But like, we have the shot of like the big cliff behind him that looks like a ramp that's very conveniently placed.
Yeah, it's just CGI over a ramp-shaped mountain. That did not look particularly good.
It like, did not.
I know that I had the benefit of like them showing me exactly what they were doing ahead of time, but like that rocky outcropping is like, that's a weird ramp-looking thing sticking out of the side of that mountain. I thought that was kind of goofy.
But like, I'm fine with that if the effect is great.
Yeah.
And then he does the jump and it's exciting and thrilling. And of course we know that he actually fucking jumped this thing and used the parachute. But like, then we cut away once he opens his parachute to what's going on in the train for a further like 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. Until all the Haley Atwell stuff. Yeah. And then she's at gunpoint and.
Until he finally crashes through the side of the train, which is a good gag. It's a
fantastic payoff.
I like that, but I think what I would have liked more is if we stayed with him and watch him make the decision to, rather than land on the top of this thing, crash into the side of it.
Yeah.
It's less thrilling. It's less, I come here for a big, dumb, like, Tom Cruise is going to show himself off doing idiot things.
Yeah.
And that didn't quite land for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I found it underwhelming in kind of a different way. But the more I think about it, I kind of like that it's a knowing joke that like we do the big stunt with him and he drives off the thing and parachutes down. And we stay with him for a while until he deploys the chute. And then, we disappear from Ethan for a bit. Him showing up as a punchline is like so cleverly knowing and like knowing what the audience expects. You're like, where is Ethan? What's happening with him? It's going to be crazy when we cut back there. And instead to just cut all of that out and stick with her and her tension. And then the relief being Ethan shows up and saves her life at the last possible second, like he said he was going to, like he always does. I find that very clever, and I think it works as a joke really well. I think that the problem is the marketing. I think they overhyped that. I think that gag would have been wonderful and thrilling in the context of the movie on its own. But in the context of the marketing, you expect there to be another thing.
Right.
And it like, and they kind of get themselves in trouble with this sometime, because like the other big thing that they marketed with Fallout was the Halo jump. Which right. like they filmed for real. They did like 50 test jumps or 100 test jumps, and it's stitched together from 6 different things, but it's actually Cruise and another stunt guy and camera operators with like, these are like parachute stunt camera operators that they
brought in. It wasn't Henry Cavill.
I don't think he did it for real. No, because he was unconscious. But they do it all for real. And you think they show you the whole stunt and all the behind the scenes stuff that comes out months before the movie. But what you don't find out, and the thing that they hid wisely, I thought, is that they end up, they're not diving over the desert, they're diving over Paris, and there's a thunderstorm. And the CGI thunderstorm kind of ruins the whole thing, I thought. Mm. I thought the CGI backdrop and the thunderstorm looked kind of shitty, and that it would have just been cooler if we just, you know, figured out how to justify it narratively without having... Because, like, you do this beautiful photo, like, this real, like, analog stunt. It's two guys on camera and the camera strapped to somebody's head and we're really falling out of an airplane. And then they have to do a bunch of CGI shit behind it. Like, I don't know. It kind of takes away from the magic for me. And so for this one to not even have a part two, to just be that, is like, it was sort of unfair emphasis. But then everything that comes after it is the real showstopper. All the stuff with the train, like, and the verticality of the train cars dangling. Outstanding sequence.
And as your wife put it, an actual understanding of momentum.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't fucking know how a train would behave in that situation. But it was really rad to be like, okay, I guess the next one's going over now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird movie. The Dead Reckoning. 'Cause the action I think is all largely superlative. But for a series that in its last couple of entries, like as I was kind of talking about before, has gotten so good at streamlining narrative down to the barest bones of just what we need to do to get to the next set piece. And not just what we need to do for plot, but emotionally. Like, emotionally, why are our characters still engaging in this insane story? For a team that has whittled that down to, like, basically just the good parts of the movies, just the exciting parts, where even the exposition is sometimes exciting. This movie is so talky.
Lots of talking.
There's so many redundant talking scenes. Like that really long scene in the beginning, the first Kittredge scene with like the national security director, and Kittredge, I guess, is CIA director. And there's probably like some FBI and NSA people in there.
Yep.
And they're just talking about the goddamn entity for what felt like forever. But I accepted it because I was like, all right, it's fine. Because they do the same thing in Fallout. The opening scene of Fallout after Ethan's first precognitive dream.
Mm-hmm.
Is him getting the good evening, Mr. Hunt. And he gets the briefing on the three bombs and Lark and the other guy and what their plan is and what they're going to do if they get the three bombs and how the things work together. And it's like, great, this is a brutal 5-minute info dump. And now there's none of that for the whole rest of the movie. And I understand the stakes and I can run with it. This one keeps stopping to do that over and over again.
Yeah. And largely says the same thing a bunch of times.
Saying the same things because there's a key and an entity, and the entity knows things, and the key maybe does something with something.
And we need to have both sides of the key because they identify each other.
Yes.
But then also we need to know what the key unlocks. And we don't know what the key unlocks, but we need to know what the key unlocks.
Yeah. Also, all right, so... we don't need to do like a plot synopsis because, like with any mission movie, there really isn't a plot. Like, I mean, there is, but the plot is always the same. The plot of any mission movie is there is a thing. The thing itself is bad, or the thing can be used to do bad things in the hands of bad people. Bad people want the thing. Ethan must keep them from getting the thing. The thing, very hard to get. Impossibly hard to get the thing. Ethan and his team will use gadgets, disguises, stealth, Olympian athletic ability, and crazy-ass balls to get the thing. There will be fight scenes, shootouts, and vehicle chases. Ethan gets away and or destroys the thing, or at the least, defeats the villain before the thing is used to do the thing. Always at the last possible second. And most times, Ethan and his team have to go rogue due to corruption, interagency politics, or being framed for international terrorism.
Yeah.
So that is the plot of Mission Impossible 1-7 and presumably also 8.
Yep.
I wonder how many times he's been at the top of like Interpol's most wanted list. Like
that's a good question.
4 times, right?
What you raise a good question with 8 though. Like we know what the thing is. Is there going to be another thing?
Well, it's 2
things. So the thing in 7 was the key. The thing key in 8 will is the entity?
The thing inside the submarine. No, the thing inside the submarine that the key unlocks is where the source code of the entity is. And they need the source code of the entity to somehow deactivate the current live on the internet Ultron style version of the entity.
Okay. Sure.
So it's a 2-phase thing. They got to get into the sub and then they got to go to wherever the entity is to download the source code. I don't fucking know. Computer is not always great with this series. Not always the most thrilling thing in the world.
Not at all.
The thing in this movie is a key that somehow unlocks or gains access to, but is also desired by the entity.
The cruciform key.
Yeah, which is itself an AI. So the big threat this time out is the algo. The algo is after Tom Cruise and his
which
team.
We think from the beginning is a thing that was made by the Russians, but it turns out that it's a thing made by the Americans.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of like weird exposition dumps in this movie. Like we don't find out what the 5-minute long submarine prologue is about until 20 minutes from the end of the movie. All we know is that the key is somehow related to a Russian sub that weirdly shoots itself down.
I assumed for most of the movie that the entity was like whatever AI was governing the stealth capabilities of this sub.
Right. I thought it was a Russian thing and not an American like like bug or like virus and that was sent to be honest, to fuck
keeping
with it.
It that simple would have probably been smarter.
Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. You know what else would have been smarter? Having just Kittredge instead of Kittredge and
Carrie Elwes.
Carrie Elwes.
Yeah.
Like, do we need two gray-haired American intelligence suits showing up at the end of the movie? Like, it was just overly complicated. It was needlessly complicated for a mission movie. But I found the AI stuff kind of chilling. I found it disturbing.
Well, yeah, because we're afraid of it now. Like, but it's a thing that's on our mind.
Like, a lot of these movies are about fate. Like, 5 is a little bit about fate, and 6 is definitely about Ethan, like, facing his fate and realizing that, like, well, if Lane says this is going to happen, then this is destined to happen. But it also means that I have that much will and strategic power, and so I can combat that and I can make it not happen, even though I'm dreaming that it's already happening.
Right.
And then in this one, the adversary that can actually predict the future is the damn AI that can predict all of your behaviors and anticipate things. I kind of wanted more of that. I found all of that very distressing. Like when the AI takes over their comms and fakes Benji's voice to lead Ethan into a trap.
And then like super reveals cool its scene. Own voice and is talking to him just like person to person.
Yeah. It's, like it's pretty they could have had
a discussion between Ethan, like for a movie that is talky, it could have been talky at that moment and like had Ethan interrogate this AI a little bit.
I don't need that, but I would have just liked a little bit more of the AI, not just using its human lackeys to accomplish its ends. Like what if the AI was fucking shit up on the train somehow, you know?
Yep.
But maybe that's why they picked a very analog steam train.
Yep. Anyway, I had a good time watching the movie.
I had a great time. Mission is always a good time. Even when they're bad, they're still a good time.
Even
Mission Impossible 2 is bad. Still pretty good time. Yeah. At the very least, you get to laugh at it for being stupid. It's so laughably dumb, but it's like, so but dumb. It's still a good time. It still works. It works for me real good.
Yep.
Do we have any other mission thoughts? I think that's the end of Mission.
Yeah, I think we're done with Mission. Are you ready for talking a little bit about wine?
Do I have to drink more of it?
No, but you're going to.
Why, who are you to say that to me? That's not your choice to make.
I am playing the part of the algorithm right now, the entity.
You son of a bitch, you are the algo. You are Don Cheadle as Algae Rhythm.
And I am predicting your behavior.
I can't drink more because I don't like it. And I'm already buzzed.
I mean,
and I'm hungry.
I'm hungry. Dude, I'm hungry.
I'm pretty hungry.
I'm hungry. So, he's making the face again. I get it. So here's the thing.
Well, hang on. Was there ever a time when you reacted to a natty thing like this the way that I am? Or did you always like them?
No, I mean, some things I think go even farther than this and are like fully devoid of character of the grape or of the place and just taste like Brettanomyces and nothing else.
Okay.
And yes, I find those to be unpleasant. My entree into natural wine. Don't fucking roll your eyes at me.
I did. I rolled my eyes
fucking,
at you.
You audibly rolled your eyes at me.
There was no sound. I checked my levels. I rolled my eyes and there was no sound
at all.
You
rolled your eyes while looking at your sound meter level, John.
Yeah, I'm doing it right now. I'm good. I'm coming in around 12. this sounds nice. I've got good levels. And look, ready? Listen.
I heard that. I heard that,
Scott. You didn't hear a goddamn thing.
So my entree into, he hates
I'm
it.
I'm sorry. You have to stop commenting on it because I'm just going to say that every time I drink something.
I know. Some. I get it. So my entree into it was like from having my first bit of education in wine was about very, very classic wines. You know, when I was working at Tashan and Dave was running the wine list, it was all really classic producers. A lot of Alsatian, a lot of Austrian Rieslings, some Burgundy, some Finger Lakes stuff, you know, largely a little bit off the beaten path appellations, but classically made. And so when I started running my own wine program at Mica, and I was able to, you know, kind of do whatever I want, but also I was conscious of the flavors that the kitchen was using, which were largely like fermented, high acid, a little bit funky, a little bit out there type flavors, I came into contact with natural wines like the wines from Frank Cornelissen or from Partida Creus, which we've had on this podcast, which you hated. Wines that
I don't
have,
recall that. What was Partida Creus?
It was during our Spanish season, which, as I recall, you liked 0 out of 6 of the Spanish wines that I chose.
Spanish. This was with parental guidance. So the Partida Creus you paired with Babe 2 and Happy Feet 2.
That's
George
right.
George Miller sequels.
That's right. And as I recall, I thought there was a little bit of a pairing because it's kind of unhinged in the way that Babe 2 is. Or rather, I thought that it paired with Babe 2, but not with Happy Feet 2.
Well, I have zero recollection of that episode, though I know I participated.
And the internet remembers. The entity knows everything we said.
I guess I'll have to listen to it.
So I came into contact with these types of wines, and it sort of opened my eyes to the full spectrum, or to another spectrum of flavors that I hadn't been accustomed to yet. And I was very, very excited by it, and sort of went down that road quite heavily and started purchasing largely natural wines, wines that most sommeliers would consider to be at least a little bit flawed. And so I still have a lot of affection for some of those wines. Now, as a more mature wine professional, I think that wines like that have given way to other producers who make wines that are just fucked up for the sake of being fucked up and don't have the rest. Like the rest of the conversation being, you know, this is the perspective of a winemaker making wine in a place. And so bringing it all together, I think that there are things to enjoy about natural wines that have volatile acidity or Brettanomyces or ethyl acetate or any of these other flaws, and also wines that are very classically hewn and focus on fruit and minerality and that type of thing. And there's a middle ground to be had. This wine, for sure, leans heavily onto the natural, quote unquote, flawed side of things. And I don't fault anyone for not liking it. I'm enjoying you not liking it a little bit because I find your stink face to be funny. But genuinely, for anyone out there who's listening, who enjoys a sour beer, who's ever had beers like Cascade out of Oregon, or any lambics or gooses like Tilquin or Cantillon from Belgium. These are beverages that are very much in conversation with this wine. This would appeal to those palates while also bringing a little bit of vinosity into the conversation. This wine has fruit character. It has minerality to it. It has the flavor markers of a thing produced by grapes, as opposed to just a thing that is a product of weird yeast strains and bacterial infection, which for sure it has.
And so fruit flavors and minerality are attributes found or described by their vinosity, would say. And you find that word acceptable to use in conversation with other people.
I do, yes.
Vinosity, the having attributes pertaining to grapehood.
That's right.
Okay. Please continue.
For the listener not watching this on YouTube or on the Tim Tams or whatever, Scott was giving me his best condescending face. his best, I am better Jamie, and smarter than you it's face.
Fine. Vinosity is totally a word. It's a great word for you to use. I think you should use it. You don't seem stupid at all when you say it out loud with that smug face on. I think it's fine. You use the words that you want to use, buddy. All right. You just go for it. You use them words.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your permission.
I'm so proud really of you. I really do. You use those big words like vinosity. Stupid ass.
I love you, buddy. So that's the flavor profile that we're in. That's what I'm responding to here. I truly do love those beers that I mentioned. And I think that there's a lot of crossover here. So if you're, you know, a beer person looking to cross over into wine, this would be a good access point for you. Just like briefly, Barry Family Cellars, I think, is a great producer. Ian, it's basically just the Ian Barry show. His wife and I believe young child participate in small amounts, but it's largely his whole deal. I was really worried a couple of years back when his tasting room got shut down that he wasn't going to be making wine anymore. It turns out it's just, you know, he wasn't able to sustain that location and has continued making really interesting wines that run the gamut from classically presenting to this. This being the very extreme side of the spectrum for him. This is, you know, Finger Lakes. I think this is Lake Cayuga fruit largely, but it's Finger Lakes Appellation. And I'm always interested to see the new releases from Barry Families. Let's talk a little bit about hybrid wines.
What is that and why?
So a hybrid variety is a grape variety that is a crossing of Vitis vinifera, which we've already established a number of times is most of the grapes you've heard of. Pinot Noirs, Chardonnay, Zinfandel,
it's Vermentino. It's the best and most importantest of all the grapes, and it was wiped out by phylloxera, and there some of it remains today, but they're all clones. Vitis vinifera, Jamie's favorite grape.
Sure.
Just like Jamie's favorite place to go and hang out after we watch a Mission Impossible movie in IMAX is
King of Prussia.
Fucking sports bar in King of Prussia. God, that place that has 60 beers on tap. Your server is basically an iPad, and they turn on TVs right above your table when they want you to leave.
I hated that so much.
So rude.
It was extremely rude.
A gigantic television hanging over the table that was blessedly off the entire time we were there. After we had settled our bill, they just turned it on and blinded Jamie.
I hated it so much. So Vitis vinifera crossed with any other grape variety.
It's a hybrid.
There are a ton of other different, not grape varieties, sorry, with other grape species.
Yeah.
Right. So
this is like a mule. Is a hybrid able to reproduce and pollinate or no?
Or are they able to reproduce on their own? That's a good question that I don't know the answer to.
You should probably find out.
It's like plant propagation generally isn't done that way. You know, when you grow when you use sexual reproduction with plants and particularly with grapes, you really have no idea ever what you're going to get. There's largely no control, but you know, Vitis vinifera can be crossed with Vitis labrusca or Ripestris or Riparia or any of the other global grape varieties, because vines are grown all over the planet and they grow wild all over the planet. You know, Riparia and Ripestris and labrusca are all native to North America. But there are Asian varieties and there are European varieties, et cetera, et cetera. And largely these wild varieties, Labrusca, Ripestris, Riparia, are more hardy, easier to farm. And that's one of the big reasons why hybrid varieties were created. Because vinifera is finicky. And after thousands and thousands of years of human manipulation and crossbreeding and all of that, you know, you go from, I use the analogy of dogs an awful lot when talking about grape varieties, but you go from wolf to pug very quickly. you know, the let's Pinot Noir being the pug. It's very, very highly specialized to and very selectively crossbred, which also means very much inbred. And for that reason, very difficult to farm. Now, in a vacuum, is that a problem? Of course not. But we live in on a planet.
In the world of wine.
We live on a planet that is experiencing a climate catastrophe.
Oh, I forgot. It's one of those episodes. This is how you started. I say, let's watch Mission Impossible movies. And you say, great, let's talk about climate change. Sure. That's fine.
I'm sorry, Scott. Well, this was largely my entry point into wine, generally speaking. Like, I was a spirits guy before I got into wine. And then I slowly realized the like measurable harm that making spirits does to the environment. And so I wanted to be working with something that was more closely related to agriculture and could be made in a sustainable way.
Spirit growing is bad?
Oh yeah. Super bad. Lots of bad byproducts, lots of bad results for ecosystems. I mean, there's a lot of complexity here, but a big bombastic example is a bourbon rick house in Kentucky caught on fire in like 2018 or whatever, and spilled hundreds of thousands of gallons of bourbon into a local river. What effect do you think that had on the ecosystem?
I mean, pretty fatal to wildlife and yep. to plant life along the river.
That's correct, yes. And how about to drinking water down?
Would like thousands of gallons of wine, like that would still
be... Well, that doesn't happen. Like that, you don't have facilities that are aging wine for the amount of time that would happen. And also, wine is not in itself combustible.
Right. So it wouldn't have exploded in the first place.
Correct.
I mean, that sounds bad.
And there's more to it than that, which we don't have to get into right now, just in the production method, even before it gets to a barrel house. But wine by its nature is more connected to agriculture. You know, there's plenty of spirits out there, and you don't even think about where the grain comes from. But it's commodity crops in the middle of the United States or wherever you happen to be, and it's not responsibly farmed. You know, there are some spirits brands that are doing great work that are trying to be more sustainable, but largely it's more difficult. You know, seeing that as a young professional, one of the reasons why I switched into wine was that, because it's more aligned with my environmental ethos. It's closer to farming. And farming can do major good, like farming responsibly can do major good for our ecosystems. And even more than that, proselytizing the ethos around farming well at the luxury level can affect farming at the more commodity level, or at least my optimistic heart hopes that that is so. Farming vinifera is harder to do in a sustainable way. You know, when you're in an area that has any amount of fungal pressure, you're going to want to spray antifungals, sulfur, whatever. If you're in an area that has any amount of a lack of vigor in the soil, you're going to want to till the soil in order to create more green growth. And tilling does a lot of bad, including erosion of topsoil, which takes thousands of years to repair. Hybrids require a little bit less. They're more hardy. You can farm them organically for roughly the same price as you can, you know, farm a vinifera variety conventionally. In the changing climate, they are less apt to not produce wine in an unpredictable, you know, weather event kind of situation that we're in right now. You know, we need to, as drinkers, sort of move our palates in the direction of hybrid varieties and co-ferments and whatever else, because vinifera, I think, is becoming unsustainable.
I have a lot of thoughts about that treatise. Please. You just revealed upon us. So I can't believe you just bottom stuffed that fucking glass.
It was like an ounce and a half left in that glass.
So no, it was because delicious. It's disgusting, not because of the volume that you just tanked.
Okay, I'm glad that we're clear on that.
Yes. So the hybrids are more resistant to the effects of climate change.
Correct.
Is it specific strains that we're crossing vinifera with that are better, or is it just the fact that they are hybrids and have more of a genetic diversity?
It's both.
That makes them more resistant.
It's definitely both.
Short answer. I like it. Okay. Two, yeah. We have to learn to adjust our palates to accept that which hybrids can produce because it's better for agriculture, and we might as well get used to it because hybrids are going to be hardier than your classic vinifera.
Right.
Will hybrids be able to make anything that tastes good, or is it just going to be like this?
Yes. There are much more classic examples even now that are produced of hybrids. A big moment for my understanding of hybrids was when I worked harvest at Red Newt in 2020. They make a wine called Blue Newt White. And it's a back sweetened kind of like mediocre wine that is made for the local palate, out of a grape called Niagara. Niagara is a hybrid grape. Scott's doing the bad stinky face again for everyone. He poured himself more. And he hates it. So that harvest season for me started off with something like 300 tons of Niagara. Every day for like a week, we were getting a lot of Niagara and processing it. And it had a particular aroma. It was very, as they say, grapey or foxy. I don't know why the term foxy exists, but it's one of those like euphemisms for it smells kind of like Concord grape juice. It is the identifier of Vitis labrusca hybrids. It's definitely in this wine, foxiness. It's a wine person's snooty way of saying this isn't good. This wasn't made from Pinot Noir or Nebbiolo or Sangiovese or whatever.
Okay, I accept the premise.
That aroma was in the air, and I learned to get used to it and then to appreciate the other components of Niagara that I did find to be quite appealing. A really, really bright florality. You know, aside from that grapiness in the air, I smelled it made the whole area around the crush pad smell like honeysuckle. It was really, really beautiful. And then as we got that wine into the tank and it sort of got through fermentation and it was treated like any other vinifera that we made at Red Newt and it went fully dry, I was able to taste with the winemaker and I was really impressed by it. It's high acid. It's bright. It's like kind of a delightful, easy drinking wine.
But it's foxy.
But it's a little bit foxy. And then in order to make it into Blue Newt White, the addition of a lot of sugar was necessary because that's the quote unquote local palate. The people who maybe don't have a fine wine palate and just want a $12 bottle of wine, you know, to drink all in one go or whatever. And I think that Blue Newt White is a great, like actually tastes good as compared to a lot of other wines that are made with that objective in mind, but the wine prior to being back sweetened was, I think, compelling, and certainly compelling enough to maybe apply different techniques to maybe make it into a pet nat or into a traditional method sparkling wine or to bottle it fully dry or to barrel age it, anything. You know, you can treat these grapes like they're vinifera because they make delicious, delicious wine. And I had a lengthy discussion with Kelby about it and about the potential. And, you know, he agrees, but he also knows the economics of it. And making Blue Newt White, you know, keeps the lights on at the winery. So he was able to have a little bit more freedom and creative control over the production methods of their single vineyard Rieslings and Pinot Gris and Syrahs and whatever. And I think that the pendulum is swinging to the point where it certainly is becoming less viable to sustainably farm vinifera. And we need to be thinking about ways to make hybrids into fine wine or adjust our palates to accept foxiness as something that is desirable. Because the only reason it isn't desirable is like not the inherent quality of foxiness. Like we like what grapes taste like. It's because we've been trained to think that wine doesn't taste that way. And that ties into, you know, comfort food, right? It comes from something that we remember. It comes from a place of where we've felt comfortable, where we've felt some emotion, some like love or camaraderie or whatever the case may be. And if that moment could be had over a vinifera or over a hybrid wine like Barry Family Cellars or like Chipika or like the American Wine Project, then I think we would be on the right track. And the movement is beginning, but we're definitely not there yet, which is why I'd like to lend my voice to it a little bit. I'm also a hypocrite because I love to drink Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Champagne and fucking Napa Valley Cabernet. Like I don't have any hybrid wines in my cellar currently. It's all vinifera.
I'm shaking my head disapprovingly at you.
I know. I'm bad.
I disapprove. I'm very disappointed in you. No hybrid wines in your cellar.
None.
A thing that I only recently heard about. And you have none of them in your cellar. What are you even doing out here? Take that pen off. Erase the tattoo. Use lasers. You are no longer Mr. Wine.
Are you done?
You are dethroned. No hybrids in your cellar.
I never had a throne, although I would love a throne. That would be nice.
Your throne would be a toilet.
I mean, I have a toilet, but in order for it to be a throne, we'd have to upgrade it.
Yeah. Well, it would be a fancy toilet.
Can I get a gold toilet?
Well, you're not getting one.
I'm going to
make
someday,
sure that happens. No.
Someday I'll be
you're
wealthy,
maybe.
You're
the bad guy who wants a gold toilet, and I'm Ethan Hunt, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep Jamie from getting that toilet.
Scott,
it's
I was
very intense with the hand movements.
You definitely don't have the invulnerability that Ethan has. When you fall, it hurts.
I can't imagine this particular mission would be all that impossible. Like stopping Jamie from getting a gold toilet. I'm not going to need to jump out of an airplane to do this. Like I feel like
I can do battle with
it.
Me, and no, I am much stronger and smarter
the toilet
than you are.
Before you ever get to it, I'll have snuck in there and taken the toilet before you ever get anywhere near it.
And then it'll be a double reversal where you'll have a fake one and I'll have the real one.
Right. But then the one that's in my toilet has a bomb, but then I take my mask off and I'm actually you. And then you die from a toilet bomb. I would not watch that movie. That would be a terrible direction for the Mission Impossible series to go, is if they just recast Tom Cruise as us. That would be horrible.
That would be, I mean.
No.
No. No. No, it wouldn't be good.
There's no version of that that's good.
I would like it because I like seeing myself depicted.
Yeah. And I would like it because you would be injured. And that would be fun. All right. You had a series of soapboxes that you stood upon. And yeah. I guess I agree with you about them. And I'm happy for you that you have strong feelings.
Thank you.
Good job. Well done. Well felt.
You're such a dick.
I don't have anything else to say, Jamie.
Yeah,
you just went off on a thing that I don't know anything about, but I guess I agree with you. I agree that you're very passionate about it, but I don't like this wine.
You don't. It's hard. This wine is a little bit hard to love, especially for someone who doesn't have, like, as you've said, you don't like sour beer.
I do not like sour beer.
But I very much like this wine. I like all the stuff that this guy does. And like I said, I think that he's got the skill set. And certainly the wines that show a full spectrum, right? It's not just the Funky Natty. He also has more classic type wines. And I think for anyone out there who's interested in exploring hybrid varieties, probably my favorite brand, that's focused on hybrid varieties is called Chipika, Chepika. It's a collaboration between a Finger Lakes winemaker named Nathan Kendall, and a New York City master som named Pascaline Lepeltier. who is the person who, you know,
who gave you the rusty nail,
who embarrassed me at my certified exam.
You're doing it again. She did not embarrass you.
I embarrassed myself. She was present
while you embarrassed yourself.
That is fair.
She asked you a simple question and you proceeded to bend over and show her your whole ass. metaphorically.
Thank you.
Yes.
But those wines are really, really carefully and thoughtfully made. And they can be a little bit difficult to find because they're very, very small production. But if you can get your hands on a bottle of it, I would highly recommend it because they're, I think, for someone with a classic wine palate, a really good introduction to what hybrid varieties can be if they're made at a high level.
And are all of those like this, or are they actually
They're much more classically. Yeah, no, you would enjoy them.
Because I hate to shit on this wine. Truly, I hate to shit on any of them because I don't know anything. And I feel bad voicing my uneducated opinions onto internet for dozens of people to share or not.
You feel bad about it. You're the only person voicing uneducated opinions on the internet.
Well, now I'm just part of the problem, Jamie. But I am open to the idea of things that are like this, but being slightly less like this.
Yeah.
I'm open to that being something I could enjoy.
There definitely are. This was the one that was readily available to me today, and I really like it. And I always love to see your sourpuss face. And I hope someday I'll just beat you into submission and you'll like sour beers and funky wines.
What does this have to do with Mission Impossible? Nothing. Right? You made no attempt whatsoever.
None at all.
I would give you pairing words.
It is a first for this show.
The initial idea was Jamie catches up on Mission Impossible.
You didn't give me pairing words.
Well, yeah, because you said you had a wine picked out.
That's true.
And I forgot. So this is nothing. This is
The reason I picked this is because while this, I don't think is my comfort food or is comfort food for anyone, I think that we need to move into a world where it could be, and where it is for a lot of wine drinkers.
Mm. Mm.
It was an opportunity for me to get on a soapbox. Let's be real. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com and tell us what your comfort food movies and or beverages are. Please tag us in any posts on the socials. Once again, at Bigger Bottle Pod, you can DM us and make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell us, at us, what is your favorite of Ethan Hunt's supernatural abilities, and we'll share it on show or internet somehow. Maybe you're partial to his motorcycle jousting skills from MI2. Or maybe you like the way that he seems to know most European languages. Or the sleight of hand magic I'm always a big fan of. Tell us, at us, we'll share. Engagement, Jamie. Engagement.
Engagement is the key to success.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our art is by Ross Connard. Thank you very much, Ross. And also big thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with the socials and with project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
But yeah, so the plot, why did I do that whole plot thing? I'm kind of buzzed.
Because there is no plot synopsis to...
But what were we talking about with Seven right before that?
Oh, that's a good question, Scott.
We weren't talking about the entity, train. What were we discussing?
We were talking about the action set pieces. We're bad at it.
Oh, no.
We lost the thread.